Welcome to Transformative Talk, Critical Conversations for Teachers. I'm Dr. Zid Haddad, a professor of instruction within the Department of Interdisciplinary Learning and Teaching at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I teach undergraduate and graduate courses in curriculum and instruction. In short, I teach teachers how to teach and save lives through the use of critical multicultural education as an approach to teaching and learning. Our podcast is produced by a different group of graduate students each week, giving them an opportunity to talk about what they're reading in my class, what they experience in the field, and how that impacts their own lives and understandings. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast from wherever you're listening. Also, you can ask us questions and engage with us further using the anchor.fm website or the anchor.fm app on your phone. You can submit questions and you can also send us voice messages. And remember, please share our podcast on all your socials so that we can build our audience. Thanks for listening, and here's today's episode.
Welcome to Transformative Talk, Critical Conversations for Teachers. I'm Kimberly Rader. I'm joined by my team members, Jeanette Laredo and Elia Trevino, and today is June 27, 2022. Our umbrella topic is Curriculum Transformation is Social Transformation. This is a three-segment conversation. Segment one covers discussion, obstacles, and tolerance in the classroom environment. Segment two covers teaching with and about film. And segment three covers social studies, social identities. We've prepared some essential questions to help facilitate our discussion that pertain to the journal articles Professor Haddad assigned in our history, policy, and critical issues in social studies education course. We three come from diverse backgrounds, ethnically, academically, and in our careers. Our content areas include ELAR, social studies history, career and technical education, speech, and financial literacy, and draw on this knowledge to further our conversation. So let's get to it. Essential question number one, what about class discussion in social studies, and are they worth the work that needs to be put in? I think we need to get some backstory on this one for some context. What do we define discussion as? We read Discussion in Social Studies, Is It Worth the Trouble? By Diana Hess, and there were four definitions offered. Excuse me. The commonality among those definitions was that a discussion would involve three or more people and the purpose is shared inquiry. What I gleaned from our classmates' responses is that the preparation on part of the students frequently is not there. All the reading and preparation must be done in the classroom. This is in order for the discussion to happen successfully. It's on the teachers to ask the right questions. So what I'm putting out to y'all is, do you feel that teachers need to structure discussions? If so, what does that entail? And is it worth the planning and instructional time? And what do the students gain from it?
Yeah, I think that in my experience as a teacher, and when I look at how I use discussion in my classroom, the way that I try and do it is making it purposeful for students. And that first requires reflecting myself on what the objective of whatever conversation or discussion I want to have with my students actually is. So I do think that it is worth the planning, but I do think that they do require that actual planning. You can't just say, oh, I saw this, on the news the other day, and I just kind of want to talk to it with my students about it. Unless, of course, perhaps you built up that rapport with them, because there are some teachers that can get to that. I would even say that there are times where I've been able to swing that. But when you're talking about academic discussions where perhaps maybe the material is not as salient to them, right? Maybe they don't have as much stake in it, or maybe they don't really know much about it, or you're just introducing it to them for the first time. Then I could definitely see where that's something that that could be an issue. And so I think that it does require structure, right? And so if you don't have it, then you could potentially lose out on what could be a great conversation. Anything from, being able to do structured talk moves, even for your students. Sometimes students just don't know how to put something together, string together their thoughts. And so being able to provide any aids in that direction also could be helpful. And of course, this all sounds like work, right? I remember when I first started, it's like, well, you have to have sentence stems for them. You have to have the talk moves for them. You have to decide on the topic. You have to decide on, discussion questions, all of that. But I think that they are worth it. And it's even more exciting when you're also able to outsource some of those things to the students, perhaps having them generate their own discussion questions, their own talk moves even. Those are just my thoughts on discussion and thinking that, yes, I think it is really important. Students absolutely love to talk. And so as far as me as a teacher goes, I'm willing to put in that effort to try and get into that point if it's something that they at least enjoy doing. I'd rather put my efforts in there than something else that they're not really going to enjoy.
What do you think that they're going to gain from it?
I think that as far as what they're able to gain from that is that if you as a teacher are able to structure a safe, affirming environment for them that they feel they can take academic and, you know, thoughtful risks with that discussion, then they're able to gain further insights than what you could have possibly done on just answering like some open-ended questions, you know? I think that if you're able to really try and, for one, like say, for example, like pre-plan your questions, right? Know for a fact how deep you can get into that material, right? On what level of knowledge you want to get your students to think. I think that you being able to reflect on that, and even furthermore, like being able to say, this is a question I want to ask this person, right? And this is a question I want to ask this person, right? Because that's how well you know your students, right? I know my student is going to get excited if I bring this up in the conversation, or if I bring up this TV show or whatever, right? I think that if you're able to plan that, and if you're able to really set that time, your students also, you're not just building up those discussions, you're building up your class culture, and your students feel comfortable just like having discussions in general, that even though to you, it is like, yes, like structured discussion and whatnot, to them, it's just kind of like, oh, it's just another day of us just like talking, right? And that's kind of how they see it. And that's how I've tried to employ that strategy in my classroom, where it's just kind of natural at the end of it. And I think that's one of the most important things we can teach our students how to do, because ultimately that's something that they'll encounter, you know, in almost any stage of their life.
What are your thoughts, Jeanette?
I think that discussion is so important in the classroom. I feel like it's prepare, let's do this, let's teacher do their homework and then present it to the students in a organizational way. Like I'm ELAR, so I'm like word wall, I'm definitions. I'm just like, let's get the terminology here. Let's try and understand the words that we're saying, because a lot of times history to me, I wasn't really loving history or social studies because I didn't have that kind of, I guess, I didn't have the greatest teachers and I didn't have that terminology. So I would shy away from it because I didn't understand it. I didn't want to get embarrassed about not knowing what to say because I would say it wrong or I'd use it wrong. So, and then I'm also Hispanic. So it was hard for me to relate because, you know, I wasn't raised talking this way about politics and things like that. So for me, I try to help that with my students and inform them what we're going to do. We tackle it by vocabulary first and look at pictures, look at videos. And then we do like little short clips of whatever the historical background is. I do teach American literature, English 3. And so a lot of that is aligned with history. And I feel like the visual aids and everything, it just set the tone for discussion and they would just flow out of their mouths. Like they were interested, they were engaged. We always used a 3-2-1 graphic organizer. It was things that you thought were interesting, two things that you have questions about, and one thing that you could contribute. It might've been a little mixed up there. I might've said it backwards or forwards, but that's the gist of the graphic organizer. And so I'm always looking for discussion. I love discussion. I am always for it. And the students, I feel like they grow because they get chances to speak. And it's so beautiful to see them use the words that we learn, the new words, the conversations. I tell them, hey, go ahead and tell your partner about whatever you just learned about. And they'll tell them, they'll respond, and then they'll converse to the one to the left or the right. So I feel like the teacher needs to prepare it and offer so many opportunities to also see it, hear it, listen it, speak it, and even be able to tell others about it, like in an essay, a speech, debrief with their own opinions and new learned information. And also learning and educating proactively, right? That's, we can't just be there reading the textbook and, okay, go ahead and answer the question. So I feel like discussion is a beautiful thing.
What do you feel that the students gain from the discussion? What kind of skills do you think that they learn, life skills?
They learn to express themselves so freely. And it is like a need in this world. I, for one, am, like I said, Hispanic, Latina, a woman. I'm a mom, and I am constantly trying to, you know, get over that shell that I've always had all my life, which was, don't speak up. You gotta, you know, be courteous. And if you don't know what you're talking about, sit there and be quiet. And if it's politics or religion, don't say a word. And so I don't want that for the youth. I want them to be able to help themselves speak out and know that there is a safe place for them to talk and also make a difference. So that's what I think they get out of it.
I'm glad that you made that connection to culture, because growing up where I did in a very diverse neighborhood, I believe there were close to 40 different languages represented at my high school. And so we had people literally from all over the world. And so we learned at a pretty early age to put some of the other world cultures aside and focus on just being human in the classroom. And it's one of the things that I really liked about the way that my high school was structured. And so I've done a lot of that within my classroom to help support my Latinx kids so that they are having that type of authenticity brought to them and freedom to speak. One of the biggest things that I have found in facilitating discussions in my classroom is that I'll throw out an essential question and I will give the kids some parameters to work within. One of the things that I say frequently is you can't yuck somebody's yum. And that means it's like, you can speak on their words, on what they are saying, the policies that they're discussing or the historical era or the event, but you cannot sit there and say you're dumb because you think this, you know, it's a no-go. And the kids work really, really well within the parameters of saying, hey, you have to take turns. Don't interrupt people. Be courteous. Don't yuck anyone's yum. And let's stick to the topic. And I started doing that when I taught in middle school, and my middle schoolers got into it and ideas were flying and they were piggybacking off of each other's comments. And I've been very fortunate that with being a career and technology teacher that I've been able to have those kids again as high school students and emerging adults and everything. And it's been really wonderful because those kids have been able to continue the process of discussing things and sharing their ideas and the critical thinking. I mean, you can see the wheels turning in their eyes and you can feel the energy in the room with them getting excited about a topic and saying, hey, I thought I was the only one that thought that way. I'm so glad I'm not alone, so on and so forth. So I think between the getting the practice of being able to have a discussion on politics, on current events, on any number of different things, because they're going to do that in the workplace. Additionally, feeling and being able to build their confidence to be able to discuss with somebody and saying, hey, you know what? I looked it up. I know this to be true. And be able to have the force of fact behind them from scholarly sources is important. And then also the critical thinking and taking in somebody else's idea and exploring that within themselves and debate or to assimilate some of it or and discard the other. So I think it's a really important life skill that our kids are getting. So moving on to our next essential question, it is, what obstacles do teachers encounter that might hamper the delivery of meaningful social studies lessons? For this one, we read What Constrains Meaningful Social Studies Teaching by Catherine Kornbluth. There were three recurring themes amongst the responses of our classmates, and they all involved climate. One was stifling, which is bureaucratic and conservative. The second is chilling, which is threatening judicial restraining. And three, drought-stricken, which in the case of our conversation here is going to include pathology and pessimism, as well as competition. So let's talk about that. What does stifling, bureaucratic, conservative look like? So like when I was a newbie teacher, one of my colleagues took me aside and warned me of people who would insist that I do things the way that had always been done. The pressure would come from them for me not to rock the boat. So she told me not to cave in. And if I needed support, she had my back. And I cannot explain how valuable that advice was. She was right. 7 years on now, we still have each other's back. So what type of experiences have y'all had regarding a stifling school environment? Have you met with anything that you felt was stifling your voice?
I would just say for this one, and also just in the interest of being brief, I could probably talk a little bit more about it in a later question. It really also just comes down to a lot of the legislation around the curriculum that is imposed on you. I feel like as a teacher, that's just been kind of the unspoken limitations that have been placed, right? Where it's, you know, for example, in Texas, just being a heavily conservative state, right, it's reflected in the curriculum that you teach. As a social studies teacher, I see that. And so I would say that that would just be one, you know, one way. There's definitely many other things, right? And not just curriculum that directly targets, not just legislation that directly targets curriculum. It's also just like targeting, for example, the daily lives of our students as well in many different ways. And so I think that right, one of the biggest obstacles we face is just the state government, right? And just the legislation, right? That is essentially the one that we have to kind of skirt around.
I feel like because I avoid a lot of, it's my personality. Like when I start seeing things getting a little bit, you know, stifling, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to back up and I'm going to obey and I am go with the flow person. So I really don't catch on to things like that, but I wish I did. I'm really opening up myself here with this discussion because I love this class and how it's made me really like, it's like, I don't know, I'm just being so courageous and speaking and finding my voice. And I've seen a lot of things happen and I just stay quiet about it. And I see, you know, not only in the school or the education in all of my past, you know, jobs, it's just the human condition to have competitiveness. And there's certain people, you know, everybody has something to bring to the table, but it's not tasteful sometimes, or it's, you know, like climate, you know, it's, that's how I loved how this, this article was written with climate. I love, you know, right now we're in a drought and then we just had a rain a while ago when my power went out, but it's just so unpredictable. And to be able to connect with those that embrace you and to be able to learn from the ones that don't, I feel like that is also something that we need to teach our youth, that you can be in the same room with somebody who is making the laws and you have to speak up. You have to be able to defend yourself and your views, no matter what, even if people don't agree with you. You still need to realize that they are human and we are all in this together and in the classroom or in the school, I feel like it's something I want to help them understand now. And I want to build this up so that every student competitiveness also, but also have a heart to share what you have with others. And then, you know, learn all the things that the legislation and the banned books and all these things that go along with climate and the parents and the students and everything that we could gain. I'm working on that. So I'm glad that this question came up.
You're doing an awesome job because I've seen you and I'm super proud of you. One of the things, because I came into teaching 7 years ago and as an alternative credential, and one of the people that was involved in our teacher training, she said, avoid the break room, stay away from the staff room because of the negativity that can be that bubbles up there sometimes. And so I didn't really believe her, you know, it's like, oh, it's just, you know, an old wives' tale, whatever. And so my first year of teaching, I walked in and I got into a little bit of a verbal altercation with another teacher because of how negatively that they were talking about the kids. And I have not eaten in the break room since. Because of, and thankfully that person's no longer one of our colleagues, but it was one of those things. It's like, no, we don't need to do that. And somebody around that time sent me an article, and it's from the website, Cult of Pedagogy. And it was awesome. And it talks about find your marigold, and it's talking about, you know, marigolds are something that are a companion plant that help other plants thrive, and relating that to teachers, and that we need to cultivate a culture where we are supportive and help people thrive, not stifle them the way that a walnut tree does, because a walnut tree, nothing grows underneath a walnut tree because it's toxic. So to stay away from the walnut trees that are the teachers with a negative attitude, and find our marigolds to help lift us up. So the next thing under that heading is, what about the situation of a chilling climate? By that, I mean like the law and order, or dare I say the I gotcha climate some administrators put out towards teachers and students. Do you feel that as teachers or as students with that kind of climate that we're put on a defensive footing?
Communication to me is key in everything. And that's how I found that, like, the chilling climate is, it can be really, really like straight, you know, chopped, karate chopped, bam, that's it. That's what you're doing. That's it. And a lot of times, you know, outsiders are cut off. I feel like, you know, everybody has to be respected and speak up also, but communication is key all around the board. And hopefully that will, you know, make the chilling, the cold shoulder, the atmosphere of the places everywhere so, so negative that the people avoid it. You know, that's my view on chilling climate.
Yeah, I think that it's sometimes you do run that risk in schools, but ultimately, right, you just do have to take a step back, right, and remind yourselves why it is that you're there in the first place. I've been in very toxic school environments, and then I've been in environments where they do put students first, front and center, and they try to decide everything based off of that, right? That's kind of like their compass. And so I've seen it done, you know, kind of both ways. And the environment that is created when you don't really put students first, when you have personalities that also are conflicting. And so that's just always kind of also guided the way that I try to interact with my colleagues, at least, while most of it does come down to just I mind my own business and I keep to myself, I also recognize that, you know, at the end of the day, like, we're all a team that's working together in the service of our students, right? And you know, we ultimately do have to lean on each other to some extent, right? And whether that extent is, you know, and since that extent, excuse me, is professional, I mean, I see no harm in trying to move away from a chilling environment, right? To where you do want to at least let your colleagues in. And I think a lot of the time, yes, it could happen amongst the, you know, the staff. Sometimes it could also just happen from administration to teachers as well. And that's also another risk, right? Where it's just, you know, different groups of educators, right? Different aims, right? That I think can also contribute to that. And so, again, just reminding yourselves why you're there at the end of the day is crucial.
Ali, I think that's a really good point that you're talking about professionalism and that our main focus needs to be on the kids and it needs to be student-centered. And I think that's a really, really important point. Thank you for saying that. So the last one under that heading is, what about drought-stricken? I mean, us here in South Texas, we all know about being drought-stricken right now. So a situation where pathology and pessimism have taken hold and competition is a major component. So one of our classmates' responses really resonated with me. And he said, I think this is a mindset that impacts minority schools. The students have limited expectations put on them when they are capable of doing great work. And I believe competition is good, but testing is not the only measuring tool, and in some ways very counterproductive to the morale of the students and the teachers. So what do y'all think?
Yeah, I think that with testing, you run a risk in placing so much importance on it. I'll never forget when I had first started teaching and my team had gotten back our test scores, and we had done great. We were at the top in terms of the traditional high schools in the district. You know, like we were at the very top school. But I just remember also my department chair just saying, well, I mean, what good did it do if the entire time we were just miserable? And it makes sense. I mean, it's something that, at the end of it, sure, right? You're getting great scores, your students are being successful, but I mean, if that just beat you down completely, I mean, then what good does it do? How are you also even going to be able to replicate that? You probably are not going to want to, just because of what you went through. And so I think that it is true. It can definitely tie in with morale, and be it good scores, be it bad scores. I mean, my scores came back too for STAR. I mean, my students did awesome, but my school year was hell. So it's not like I really was celebrating those scores for me. I mean, I was celebrating them for my students. I was proud of them. But I mean, ultimately, it does kind of cast a dark shadow at the end of the year. And sometimes it's even exacerbated by the fact that, you know, you kind of don't even get really a lot of recognition or any sort of like kudos or any sort of like acknowledgement, right? Just because you're also with the craze of the end of the school year. So it just, I mean, it can work both ways, right? And so sometimes it can even work to a fault as well. So that's what my thoughts would be on that.
I have the same feeling. You work so hard toward testing, and then I remember being so liberated when they said, all right, STAR's done. You can go ahead and have some fun with your new lessons. Have fun with it. Still, you know, stay with the lesson plans, but, you know, it's not so hard. And when I saw that, I got to introduce Shakespeare and all, you know, all these fun things and introduce, you know, literature that I liked and enjoyed. And I wish that they would just let us teach what we love, our forte, you know, the part of our jobs. But yeah, it's a tedious work, I guess. Like Elia said, it would be great to have some recognition or something. I don't know. But at the end of the year, it's very liberating and it's very short-lived because I swear I blinked and it was over. And yes, go ahead.
I think it's a little ironic that a lot of school districts are pushing the seven mindsets of successful people as social emotional learning. And one of those planks is passion first, isn't it? And with that, it's like, we're taking a lot of passion out of the kids and kind of like, just do it, do it, do it, do it, do it. And it's like, why aren't we instilling passion in the kids in learning in the curriculum? And it just seems very counterproductive to me on that level. It's just kind of, to me, it's bizarre. And it just doesn't seem like, it just, to me, it seems hypocritical. But one of the other things was that, because I'm not a testing teacher because I am in career and technical education, so I'm not involved in the STARS. There's been a couple of really big moments related to them that really stand to illustrate how much a drought-stricken climate impacts the kids in relation to the standardized testing and in relation to how they feel about the STAR. And several years ago, there was a young man that he wasn't doing well during freshman year, and he took the STAR and he didn't pass. And he went through sophomore year and he was doing a little bit better in his academics, but again, he didn't pass his STARS. And then same situation junior year. And then senior year, he ended up pulling straight A's and he got his results at the end of the school year. And he was at the opposite end of the school. And he and his best friend, I hear them running down the hall because and they're hooping and hollering and like, oh my God, we did it. We did it. We did it. We did it. And they started pounding on my classroom door and I opened the door and they like literally the two of them picked me up and twirled me around. And that's no small feat. And they're like, we did it. And I said, well, what did you do? And they said, we finally passed. And so, you know, it's like that type of thing. It's like, you know, the old song about, you know, when the rain comes down on a sunny day, it was that kind of a situation. The sense of accomplishment that they had, that they'd finally been able to accomplish, and it's like, it finally pushed that drought aside. But this past year, I have this kid that was a sophomore and she didn't pass the STARS freshman year. And going into the STARS this year, her stomach was just tied up in knots and everything. And so I went to administration and I said, I know this kid will feel better if she can chew gum. And they're like, what? I said, if she can chew gum, then her fidgets will be down and she can concentrate better. And so is it okay if I make sure she has gum before she goes in, because y'all are about no gum in the school, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, yeah, if it's going to work, do it. So it was like one of those things where it was nice to see that they were supportive in us trying to push that drought back a little bit so that the competition within that child's own head was diminished a bit. And that, you know, that kid chewed gum during the entire thing. She came out afterwards, her jaw was sore, but she said she felt better and she could concentrate. So I think that was a really good thing. So the next essential question is, why should service learning be included in social studies? For this one, we applied to service learning in social studies method course experience and place-based curriculum by Reese H. Todd and Stephanie Gray Brinkman. The text referred to a partnership between schools and museum where students went to the museum to learn about prairie dogs, their habitat, predators and prey, and how they can be helpful and a hindrance to farmers and ranchers. And At the end of it, a live prairie dog was taken to visit the class. Since museums are in the business of education, it is a likely partnership and a wonderful example of how to incorporate one avenue. But that's not the why. So what is the end goal of service learning? Why is it important to incorporate service learning into our curriculum? And what do the students ultimately gain from it? So, because we're running a little bit short on time, some of the things that I gleaned from it was meaningful service, curriculum connection, and student leadership. Do you guys agree with that?
Yes. I also feel like they got a sense of community giving back to what they were, their environment, their skills. They were growing and learning with others in the community, not just in the classroom.
Correct. And I think it just shows also that they're able to transfer some of those skills into their actual community. I think real world application is very important in the curriculum. And so this is an avenue that they're able to do that with service learning.
So the next question is, how can we utilize essential questions for connecting learning? With our facilitations in class and this subsequent podcast, we purposely used essential questions to model how to ask essential questions to connect our and our classmates' learning to the text and to further the discussion. The text we applied to was Connecting Learning, How Revisiting Big Idea Questions Can Help in the History Classrooms by Rob Virgin. This speaks to relevance. A classmate of ours chose the following quote: "Is the classroom needs to be a place that equips students with the skills and interest necessary to delve into their own deep inquiry so they can identify problems and find answers relating to the subject outside the classroom setting." And their response was, "This is all about teaching through critical thinking, which I think in social studies is current events. For me personally, having an essential question put before me, or in some cases creating them for myself, is what puts me down the rabbit hole of self-evaluation, creating relevance to me and a desire for deeper understanding on the subject. What do y'all think?"
I would agree. I also think it's a way to organize your curriculum, right? Your content for your students. If you're also being direct in what you want them to think about when they're, deciphering, right? Or analyzing a lot of the sources or things in your content that you're exposing them to. With essential questions, that's something that I know in my school, they were pushing a lot, just because, again, it goes back to how your classroom is organized and how you're wanting to get your students to think about the material is very important, because especially for classes that are like AP, for example, where you have a lot of sources that you need to introduce to your students or that they need to analyze, right? Those essential questions can kind of help them organize their thoughts, and also essential questions invite their opinions, which I think is a way to be able to also practice their argumentation skills. And so I think that that's why essential questions can be very important.
Yes, essential questions are important in connecting, learning, revisiting big questions, and just focusing on student diversity, differences, having their voice again. Also using like, what's the conflict and what can we do to fix this so we don't repeat the same things in the future?
Thanks. The next question before I hand this over to Jeanette is, where does your understanding and opinion lie in delivering intellectually challenging social studies opportunities in the middle school years? The text we applied to was Teaching Intellectually Challenging Social Studies in Middle School Problems and Possibilities by Hillary G. Conklin. One of our classmates chose the following quote: "As the educational psychologist Jerome Bruner explained, any subject can be taught effectively in some intellectually honest form to any child at any stage of development. According to Bruner, learners of all ages are ready and able to take part in substantive intellectual work. Their response was, any notions contrary to this quote indicate an educator lacking in pedagogical preparedness, continuing development, and or support resources. I agree with the statement. Having taught middle school, college, and career readiness, we delved into social studies as applied to potential future careers in personal morals and ethics that support and eliminate them. And these were discussions with 6th to 8th graders. So what do y'all think about that one?
It just prepares them for life and gets them ready for the real world. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think it would just raise the expectations for the students.
I agree. I think in a lot of cases, what we do is we set the bar really low, and then we are surprised when they meet that challenge, but don't go any further. Okay, so this wraps up the segment one, and I will be handing it over to Jeanette. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is Jeanette, and my question four is, how and where do movies take place in the social studies classroom? Jeremy Stoddard's article, Teaching with and About Film, is one of the readings we had to read. And one of the most important questions was, what separates teachers who use film thoughtfully versus the teachers who make the choice of using film as a reward or to replace a lecture? What do y'all think about that important question?
Well, I think it's important because the kids have such a connection to social media. And even though I'm cautious about getting into the whole thing about edutainment, I think that if we are setting it up ahead of time, saying, okay, yes, this is either a documentary. We have to make sure that when we're looking at that documentary, that we understand where the source is coming from, because it could be a situation where that documentary is very biased. Making sure that we set it up. It's like, okay, you know, there is some bias in this. Let's be aware of this and get some essential questions for them to help guide their understanding as they're watching it. And then at the end of it, then they can answer those questions and they can participate in a discussion about what did they see that was factual? What could possibly be propaganda? Where does the bias lie? So that they're learning the critical thinking skills along with some historical fact. Additionally, if they go into watching something that is fictional, there is a lot of stuff that you can use where there may be historical facts included in it, and you can use it as an opportunity to say, okay, yes, this is based on real life people, but it, you know, there's drama or poetic license, if you will, that's been added in for entertainment value, and setting up again those essential questions of what you're wanting them to look for so they can focus more on the specifics. Like you and I were having a conversation the other day about how to illustrate certain things historically, and you were going to be using movies based on Shakespeare, and I brought up Star Wars. So we know Star Wars is completely fictional, but there are things that can still align that could be useful. Would I show the whole movie? No, I would show just the clip. Let's say the pub scene, for example. It's one of my favorites, but it has value as far as talking about social norms and mores and you know, cultural things that could be really helpful. And there's a way to structure it with the kids so that they're gaining something from that.
Yes, very good. Ilya?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it all just depends on how you're presenting it to the students. You want to make sure that they're remaining engaged throughout the film. It's very easy for them to potentially lose interest right as they're watching, just because maybe it just doesn't catch their attention. They're more susceptible to have their phone out, talk to a friend, whatever. So just making sure that you're planning how you're thinking about engaging them. Also not shying away from having discussion throughout the film. Sometimes I feel like, you know, teachers might just want them to watch it all the way through, right? Not really leaving much room for debriefing throughout. And so I think that that's important to just be able to do with your students. Again, going back to discussions, as long as you just have a purpose for them, as long as you know exactly what you want to get the students to understand with that discussion, with that movie, whatever it is, then it is worth it, in my opinion. And teaching with home has been one of my favorite things to do. So I would continue to do it, obviously, as long as I know what my students are going to be getting out of it. And of course, that I can justify saying, like, yes, I'm showing this movie because I'm gonna teach my students about X, Y, Z with it.
Yes, very good. I feel like exactly what both of you said is to have an effective way of teaching literature to a movie or historical events to a movie. A lot of times you have to also teach them the use of camera angles and the lighting and why did they put this in this segment and not this and why not this first? Why the flashback? Or it all depends on the director's why. Why did the director do it? And then you have to also, you know, do the historical events, like the actual facts. So I always did like similar to our dialogue readings where you had the original historical event and the precise things that happened in history, what you're studying, and then the director's view and their perception of it and what they were trying to make the viewer believe, if they were trying to sway them a different way or if they left certain things out, if there was any bias, like you said, both of you said. So very good. So whenever you introduce film to your students and taking in the importance, y'all both said y'all enjoy it. And I really like to hear that because I enjoy it as well. And I really, really am just excited to do this in my lessons every year. And I always do short films, short clips to also engage because I'm a visual learner. And we also have to remember that most of our students were born with a screen right in front of them. They have not ever really been detached from it. So a lot of the times this generation is very driven by visual. Even I am as well, but I am a theater English person, so I love it. But it's a very nice thing to see when students can relate what really happened and what the author was trying to make and the author's purpose in the ELAR class. And then they see how, you know, they decipher what they were trying to do. And then they make up their own ways of thinking. I even had where teaching Romeo and Juliet, they made an alternate ending where it caused them to also say, okay, well, you know what, this is something I want to try. And they had fun with it. So, thank you very much. That is it.
Hi, everyone. So this is Aaliyah. I'm going to be covering the last couple questions for our facilitation. The last part here with our segment really is around the idea of the place that race and class in particular have in our curriculum. With this one, we're also focusing special attention on Trayvon Martin's story, given that it was featured in one of the optional readings, the curriculum tragedy, which was focusing a lot about how African-American men are studied and analyzed in curriculum, applying different lenses, such as with critical race theory and critical race feminism, and also the idea of counter storytelling. It brings up a good point that most negative stereotypes of African-American men do run rampant, but seldomly there's never really studies made to drill down to the root cause of some of those stereotypes. Also, a lot of this curriculum, while it does explore a lot of tragedy, oftentimes it also leaves out a lot of hope and joy in some of these stories. And so because that is oftentimes how race and class are introduced and talked about in class, Even though whether you think they do have a place in the classroom or not, that's usually, you know, kind of the how they're told, right? Through stories like Trayvon Martin's. And so the premise of the readings is, how can you counter that, right? How can you create a different story to that? Or what's a different perspective, different dimension that you can bring in understanding for your students? Also with race in class and some of the readings, it was discussing how one can't really go without the other, kind of like that chicken and egg argument. And so with the talking about race and class, you know, in just a little bit, we'll talk about, you know, what role does it have in the classroom? And then how do we as educators, right, learn to walk that that line with our students? So I guess just get us started with social studies, where I guess promoted to talk a lot about social identities with our students. We have a very good place to be able to help our students develop certain social identities, such as race, sexual orientation, ability, status, gender identity, even some of their political affiliations. And so I guess just to get us started, any social identity that y'all can think of, you can pick any. How would you help your students sort of develop that identity in the social studies classroom?
I think for me, one of the big things in social studies that I've noticed is that women are usually, on by and large, left out of history. That, you know, the men are always the major players. And so for the girls in my classroom, or people who identify as female, that I would definitely do everything that I could to support the female voice being heard, so that that there's power in womanhood, and there's amazing things that have been done by women in history, and that needs to be brought to the forefront. And it's not just in history, but in the social sciences as well. And I think that's something that we need to all support, and saying, oh, hey, I found this article, or hey, did you see this in this movie or this TV series? Things to help bring things to the forefront so that those voices could be included.
I don't see too much like racial criticism, but I do see like social criticism, like, or like clicky things, like the jock and the loudmouth and the quiet one, and so like whatever they're wearing, sometimes they're just really petty like that. And so I try to make them understand their raising, their situation, not necessarily saying it, but I will pick stories, or I am a very good, they think you can't hear them in the classroom while they're talking, but I will listen sometimes and be like, I'm going to show this video tomorrow about, you know, just trying to create a healthy place for everybody. A lot of times I had a student who always wanted to dwell on just the negative of the day and the hallway and the happiness in my classroom. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're total opposites. You should have this part and I should have this part. And I visit yours all the time, you know, like, and people were like, you feel, you know, sad sometimes. Like, they were shocked because I always have this persona, this very happy feeling place. And so I was like, yes, I'm hurting right now about a few things. And sometimes it's because I'm a woman, or because I'm a mom, or I'm thinking about my family members, or, you know, just things in general about things that happen in your brain that you're trying not to think about because you're concentrating and learning in the class. And sometimes people pick on you in the classroom, and maybe I didn't catch on to the racial part of it. Maybe it happened in the hallway. Maybe, I don't know, but I try to really make them think that they are human and they have to respect. And maybe that's why I, I don't really see it, but I'm prepared for it. I will try my best to prepare for it.
One of the things that I got from the reading was talking about you can't separate race and class when we're talking about these kind of issues. And one of the things that I have noticed that with some of the kids, there's definitely some of the kids look down on their classmates because they have like an elitist attitude, and it's not necessarily race-based, but some of the kids are downright snobs. And it hurts my heart. And it's like, no, we're not going to talk to somebody that way. And so I think what we need to do is to, when we're facilitating these courses and bringing different voices into the room, that we're making sure that, you know, that good people from all walks of life are being focused upon, so that, and even some villains. I mean, we need to see villains from all kinds of walks of life, so that it's, you know, it's only rich people that are good and poor people that are bad. No, that's not the case. And I don't think that they see that enough.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I was thinking also about how I would approach and respond to this. And I would agree also that, you know, like, for example, gender identity being one of them that I would very much want to bring to the forefront, as well as like with sexual orientation, since, of course, that is in just a sort of a way to be able to feel also liberated in my being an educator as well, I think. Is important because there's a lot that goes into legislation, right, that prevents teachers from talking about those topics of sexual orientation, gender identity. And so that's just my way of resisting. And so that would essentially be one of the identities, right, that I would like to bring in. But that's on obviously a more personal level. What I would say, though, that I think would, not that that wouldn't benefit my students academically, but I think something that would even more so further enhance that is bringing in a lot of talk about class and socioeconomic status, because I think that that's something that when we're looking at intersectionality of social identities is at the forefront, you know, at the center of everything, at the center of gender identity, at the center of sexual orientation, of ability status, religion, and, you know, how y'all were talking about that, where there's a sense of elitism sometimes. And so I think that that's something that I've been able to see too, and that I think is important that students also understand the intersectionality of it, that there's no single group, right, that tends to fall into that umbrella. And I think that that might also counter their narrative of what they expect that to always look like. So thank you for responding to that. I think for the next thing that I wanted us to just touch on was the story of Trayvon Martin. And the way that it was essentially being used, right, in the readings. So in the readings, right, it's being used as an example of how Black men are essentially discussed, right, in curriculum, and how a lot of the time they're viewed through that curriculum of tragedy, right? We know that Trayvon Martin, he was a young 17-year-old African-American boy who was murdered by George Zimmerman, and he this happened, I believe it was in Florida. And it was definitely a widely reported trial that was going on during that time. We do know that Zimmerman ends up getting acquitted, right, from the murder of Trayvon Martin. And so there's definitely a lot of tragedy that is tinged throughout this story, right, that is used a lot of times in classrooms. But again, it's used in many classrooms, but the way that it is debriefed, right, the way that it's talked about, the way that it's discussed, it can vary, right? Based on where you're at. And so I guess my question with this one and what we were talking about here is how does his story and multidimensionality lend itself to social studies? In other words, what are some other stories that can be highlighted in social studies in a similar manner that touch on issues of race, of socioeconomic status, of gender, that also have a contemporary setting to them, right, that resonate with our students? And so this can be anything, right? Even if you can't think of something that is anchored in race, maybe just something that's current, What would y'all say would be maybe a story or something that can be used in a similar manner in class?
That's a challenging question. My thought was, honestly, I could probably take any character from history or from current events and start the discussion with my kids and say, okay, let's talk about the multidimensionality. How many hats does this person wear? You know, is it, you know, if it's somebody male or somebody presenting male, then is this individual somebody's child? Are they a parent, a grandchild, a student, an employee, a cousin, a best friend? You know, how many different hats does that person wear? They're important to somebody. And that value of them as a human being needs to be the thing that is held up most, especially if they met with a tragic end. Because when we focus, it's like, I remember for the long time, remembering, you know, Zimmerman's name. Zimmerman wasn't the most important person in this scenario. Trayvon Martin was. And what ended up happening with him and his demise because of this absolutely ridiculous situation. This should not have ever transpired. But we could do the same thing with everybody that we want to talk about on any topic and be able to present their strengths and their contribution to society. Even, I mean, my family and I we were talking the other day about the LA riots. And that's before my kids were born. And I was in my early 20s when the LA riots happened, and I was talking about it with my kids in school one day. And it was like when the movie Straight Outta Compton came out, I want to say, or the rehash, the biopic of the guys that did that. Excuse me. And so they were saying, oh, well, you know, the LA riots just happened in LA. I said, first of all, you guys need to understand about how big LA actually is. And you need to understand that just like with George Floyd, it spilled over into all of the into a lot of other major cities. And then we got to talking about what precipitated the situation that created the LA riot situation, just like with what we had seen with George Floyd. And one of the things is like, oh, well, with George Floyd, you know, he had done crimes in the past. I said, but that hasn't got anything to do with what happened with the police brutality. And so we started talking about his multidimensionality as a Black man under certain circumstances and, you know, who he was important to and set aside, you know, something that happened in the past because it wasn't relevant to the exact situation. So that's how I would handle it. Cause I'm honestly not coming up with an exact story other than what I just outlined.
I taught English 3, and one thing that resonated with my students was when we read Frederick Douglass's From What to the Slave is 4th of July. And here we are embarking in this week. And it was about how Americans celebrate 4th of July. And during Frederick Douglass Day, it was the slaves couldn't even celebrate at all. And even me reading it again as an adult, it didn't hit me as hard as it when I was younger. But now it did. And a lot of kids, a lot of students were like, they gasped. Some of them were like, oh my gosh, I didn't think about them. And it's like, this is a man who spoke, who wrote about the way that he felt. And they really embraced it. And I was like, what do you have to say to the world? What is your, what bothers you about how you are treated? What can you say? How can you make a speech? You can do anything. I try my best to tell them that the world is theirs. They want to make a difference. They can. They have to have their voice out, just like Frederick Douglass and King, anybody, everybody's voice is important. And nowadays people are listening and we have all these social media platforms and they just need to go and be better and have a plan to just improve and not necessarily judge everybody they see and come with a closed mind to everybody. They've got to be open-minded and accept. And a lot of these things are brought in by a fear factor. It's something that fear brings in. What are they afraid of? What is the people building them in? What are they afraid of? Their upbringing. What did they tell them about these, you know, people, whether it's African-American, Hispanics or Caucasian, whatever it is. Why are they so wanting everybody to sway with them? Let everybody be original and real and bring something to life and create and be better every day.
Thanks, y'all. And as y'all were talking, I was also thinking too about different ways that I in my social studies classroom have tried to bring in multidimensionality to my students through some of these tragic stories. I'm thinking in particular, like for example, when we bring up the Tulsa Race Massacre that happened in the 1920s. That's nowhere in the curriculum, but I bring it up because in the curriculum, it still asks you to talk about the racial violence that was going on during the time period and everything that was going on with the Ku Klux Klan. And I would be remiss, right, if I didn't bring that up. And so it's something that I still use it to teach the standards that I need to. But I mean, nowhere does it explicitly say teach the Tulsa Race Massacre, right? But at the same time, the reason I also like to bring it up as well is because even though it is, yes, a tragic story, it does also provide students with a different perspective of seeing Black people thriving in an environment during the 1920s that they probably thought, you know, this wasn't happening. And I think it then helps them see, right, the racial violence that was going on from a different perspective, and then also see the perpetrators of that violence in a different perspective because of the way that they've traditionally been showcased in history, right? It's a different light that they're kind of pushed to see it under. And so I think that that's also the importance of multidimensionality as well, is that it can uncover some of those truths, right, within history for students. So I guess that just kind of leads us into that last question, which pretty much is what a lot of what we've been talking about has been chipping away at, and it's whether or not we agree or disagree with whether class and race have a place in social studies when we discuss it. I know that for that, it can be a simple yes or no question, right? Whether you think it does belong in the classroom or not. So I would just encourage you to kind of, you know, explain a little bit as to why you're making that determination. But ultimately, I just kind of want to get your thoughts on what you think about that. Do y'all think that classroom race and social studies have a place? If so, how? If not, you know, why?
I feel there has to be a distinguished class and race, because if not, then what do we teach? Like, there's no color, there's no flavor, there's no, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, it's just gonna be, I don't know. but I feel like they have to be authentic to them, and they do have to know who they are. And they still have to embrace what they come from, and they still have to identify with the class and they look like the race, you know, like I feel it's important. And I want them to be unique. I want them to stand up for what they want. I don't want them to be swaying and being quiet about following along with others or trying to conform. I would like them to be original and in their own way, but that also teaches others around them to say, hey, I may not agree with your class or look like you, but I am going to embrace you. You have something that we can all agree with. We can all get along. We can all play ball together. And you know what? You are you and I am me. And this is our world. And so it's just about acceptance and learning in the classroom. And that's what I'm about. I believe that class and race does exist, but it does not have to raise any kind of negativity. There's a safe zone and they can say what they feel. Of course, there's debates, there's times for speeches, there's times for, you know, so many times for them to speak up and say and have different views. And that's what I feel about that question.
When it comes to the question of class and race, from my perspective, is that it has to be talked about. Because if we're looking at it from a historical perspective, and we want to call it the ruling class or the elite in this country, who were they? You know, and so we definitely have a class and race situation there. And if we look at slavery, there was a class and racial situation there. If we look at people who were immigrating from other countries, there is a class and a race situation there as well. Otherwise, we wouldn't have really awesome vacation spots to go visit, like Little Italy, Little Tokyo, you know, Chinatown, things like that, because that all has to do with race and class and social constructs and things of that nature. And with, you know, and we've got Native American kids out there, and they're dealing with race and class as well. And so when we bring up things about race and class, and we're talking about them in the social studies classroom, or we're talking about it in psychology or sociology or education and training, I think it's really, really important for one, for the kids to see themselves represented in the content, and two, to be able to see and understand what it is for somebody that's not in your race and or class. Like I had mentioned before, with me growing up where I did, we had so many different nationalities represented, and we had a whole bunch of different social classes that were included in that were from their home countries or in the way that they were raised, in addition to where they fit into American society. And so you've got the multifaceted situation within one person. And in a lot of cases, it's like when we would say where we went to school, it's like, oh, you must be rich. It's like, dude, no, you have no idea, you know, that there were some assumptions that were made about us. It was, you know, elite, definitely with some of the kids, but not with all. And so that's, I think, one of the things that we need to help illustrate with talking about race and class is to help put away stereotypes. We need to help diminish stereotypes and diminish bias by shining a light on the variety. You know, variety is the spice of life.
Well, thank you all so much for responding to that. Do you all have any last comments or anything that y'all would like to add before we wrap up?
I just really enjoyed having this conversation with y'all. Thanks for being on my team.
You're welcome.
Likewise.
Yes, likewise.
Okay, so this is Raider, Jeanette, and Elia signing off. Thanks for listening.